We part way through chapter 4 last time, and I think the last thing we were discussing was the rainbow and whether there were rainbows before the flood or not. A rainbow appears first of all in Scripture after the flood, and that question is debatable maybe. But there's no question what the rainbow means here. It stands for the mercy of God. And this would indicate that it's round about the throne of God, like an emerald. This would indicate that for God's children, the storm is over, and they are in victory over it. Now, it speaks of the sea of glass, like unto crystal. This is the counterpart of the sea that was a large container that held a large quantity of water before the tabernacle and especially before Solomon's temple. And then there were smaller lavers at which the priests were to cleanse their hands and their feet. This calls to our mind the cleansing power of the blood of Christ. And it speaks now of four beasts. This should be translated, as it is in more recent versions of the Bible, four living creatures. You see, we get this word beast has an unworthy meaning today. You think of a wild beast or an unclean beast of some kind. I saw a possum on the Geneva campus night before last, walking along the drive at the top of the cliff. Not my nomination for the nicest looking animal, although he was behaving quite properly there. But this word beast in Greek here, from the word for life, zoa, living creatures, creatures having life, and there is no idea of anything base or unworthy, quite the contrary. So this should hardly be translated beasts in our day and age. Four living creatures. These are certainly identifiable with the cherubim of the book of Ezekiel, chapter 1 and again chapter 10, even though there is a difference in the details of the description. I think maybe I mentioned that, or did I, that cherubim is the proper plural and cherub is singular. Did I speak on that last time? Well, you read sometimes in the Bible cherubims. This is improper. A cherub is singular. In Hebrew, you form a plural of a masculine noun by adding im. One cherub, two cherubim, three cherubim, and so on. And a feminine noun by adding eth or oth. Jehovah of Sabaoth. It's a feminine plural, the Lord of hosts. So cherubim is already plural. And if you put an S on that, this is like saying one mouse, two mice, three mice. It's superfluous. One mouse. Well, all right, cherubim. Now, you realize that while these are represented as an order of angels, it is not the purpose of either Ezekiel or John to give a description of them from which we could, let's say, identify one if we'd see one someplace. The cherubim are spiritual beings, an order of angels, who do not, therefore, in themselves have a physical body. Now, obviously, if John or Ezekiel were to see them, was to see them in a vision, they had to have some appearance. So they are recorded as they appeared to these inspired writers, Ezekiel and in the New Testament, John. But this is a description in metaphorical or figurative language. The six wings stand for activity, surely, in the service of God, and so forth. And the description has meaning of the different characteristics of these living creatures, but not to be taken literally. I take it, the cherubim, first mentioned in the Bible in the Garden of Eden, right after Adam and Eve had fallen and had come under judgment and had been expelled from the Garden of Eden, the Lord placed the cherubim at the entrance with a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way of the tree of life. And whatever this was, it was something that would frighten Adam and Eve and anybody else later from attempting to get in the Garden of Eden again. People have raised the question, how long did that remain there? Was that there until the time of the flood or till when? And this cannot be answered. But to guard the way to the tree of life, which Adam and Eve had forfeited the right to eat by their rebellion and sin against God, so the cherubim were put there to guard it. Now this gives a key to the idea of the cherubim. These are angels or angelic beings which stand guard to protect the holiness of God from any profanation, from any trespass that would be contrary to it. They guard the holiness of God and the holy things of God. And we notice this here, it says, they rest not day nor night, saying, Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, which was and is to come. The wings, I take it, stand for activity, and the eyes for knowledge. They are intensely aware and alert as to what they're supposed to be alert about. And then they shout or they cry out and say, Holy, holy, holy. There's a triple holy to represent the holiness of God. Now we should realize that when the Bible speaks of God as being holy, there are two distinct meanings of this. One is holy is used of God to describe his infinite greatness. If you want a philosophical term, which I try to avoid, metaphysical, this is what God is in himself, his infinite greatness, his transcendent greatness, far above all created beings. This is called the holiness of God, by which he is lifted up so that no creature could possibly compare with God in point of greatness or majesty. This is the first meaning, his incommunicable attributes. You realize that in describing God, the Bible and the theology based on the Bible distinguishes the attributes of God into incommunicable and communicable. The incommunicable attributes of God are those qualities of God which only God can have. To be omnipotent or almighty, this is only possible for God. To be omnipresent, to be omniscient. Only God can be everywhere at once. Only God can know everything. So these are incommunicable attributes of God. And we will never attain unto these. It is contrary to our status as creatures to share in the incommunicable attributes of God. Now these can be summed up in the Bible by this term holiness. God's infinite greatness, the infinite difference between him and all created beings by which he is so highly exalted and lifted up. That's the first meaning. And the second meaning of holiness is ethical. God's separation from all that is evil or sinful or unclean. And in this is one of the communicable attributes of God that we can share in. So we read that we are commanded, Be ye holy, for I am holy. Another place it says in Epistle to the Hebrews, I believe, we are chastened of the Lord that we might be partakers of his holiness. This is the second meaning of holiness, the holiness of God, the ethical holiness of God, his moral purity, in distinction from all that is sinful and is evil. Now, I'm not sure which the cherubim had in mind there, or maybe both of these ideas, although you can trace both of them out in, certainly in many other places in the Bible. The strong emphasis here is on the eternity of God. Notice three times in the closing verses of chapter 4 here, God is spoken of as the eternal one. Verse 8, which was and is to come. Verse 9, who liveth forever and ever. And verse 10, that liveth forever and ever. So there's a triple emphasis here on the eternity of God. Now this is, of course, part of his absolute holiness, and it is something in which we cannot share. Where were you 100 years ago? Well, I guess there's nobody here over 100 years old, so I'm safe asking that. Where were you 100 years ago? Or, if you will, 1,000 years ago. This will include even Methuselah, you know. 1,000 years. You were only a thought or an idea in the mind of God. So your life had a beginning, and so did mine. And you had a birthday, and you count your age from then to whatever it is today. Now, if you are a Christian, you are going to live forever, so you have eternity of a creaturely kind, of course, projected into the future, but not backwards into the past like God. And God is spoken of as eternal, you see, in the sense of transcending time. This recalls that statement in Augustine's Confessions. I think I have mentioned it before, probably. It's worth quoting again, though. And this man lacked a sense of humor, absolutely lacked a sense of humor. He grappled with the relation of God to time and says he heard the question asked, what was God doing before he made the world? And the answer given, he was getting hell ready as a place to put people who asked too many questions. And Augustine, a good man, was unable to see anything humorous in that, and said it was an unworthy answer to a serious question, and he would answer it, so he answers it through several pages. And I assure you, it's heavy reading. You can read it if you wish. And finally comes up with this: the question cannot be answered because the question itself does not mean anything. When you say before or after, you have already assumed that the person you are talking about is a citizen of the kingdom of historical time. This is not true of God, although it is true of us. Therefore, to ask what was God doing before he did something else is a meaningless question. Now, we should realize, of course, that God transcends time, as we don't. Past, present, and future are certainly tremendously real to us. Our life is geared to this. We can't get out of this any more than a catfish in the Beaver River, I'm told that's the only fish they have left there now, can get out and say, I'm going up the cliff here and go to college. This is contrary to its nature. And we are geared, you see, to space and time. Space and time are the framework of the creation. The field that God built in which matter and energy and personality can act and interact, and that's our life. But God is above this, so there's a strong emphasis here on the eternal character of God. Now notice also in this last part of the chapter the God-centered character of everything. The 24 elders cast their crowns down before the throne of God and say, God is worthy to receive the glory and honor and power, and because he is the author of all creation, the God-centered character of it. Now, They have crowns. Stephanos is the Greek word, crowns of victory, garlands or crowns of victory. But you see, in the glory of heaven, they recognize that this is only by grace. They owe it to God. And so the human crown is cast before the throne of God. This is a dramatic effect here, surely, to bring out strongly the glory and the majesty of God. Now, some years back in the Reader's Digest, there was a piece, I believe a book supplement, by a woman who claimed she had been dead for a period of time and come back to life, and she had been in heaven, and she described it. She asked me, I think she was a little bit cracked, but she said she had been in heaven. And they published this, and she described heaven. It's sort of pale blue and smells good. And they have nice background music and so forth, but she never mentioned God, and she never mentioned Jesus Christ. Now I ask you, what kind of a heaven is it without God? Isn't that what makes heaven heaven? The favorable and loving presence of God to his people. And it is the absence of this that makes hell what it is. Place without love and without the, let's say, favorable presence of God. She described heaven without God and without Christ. Now I wonder, are there those of our fellow Americans today who expect to go to heaven and yet who have no particular sense of the importance of God? Almost everybody, barring a few atheists, expects to go to heaven. The sense of immortality is built into us and is not easily gotten rid of. You ought to be sorry for the poor atheist. He's fighting against not only all reason and scripture, but against something that's built into himself, too. The belief in a life after death is all but universal in the human race. And yet, how many millions of people there are who expect to go to heaven, and when their funeral is held, some preacher will preach them there too, who are living without God, to whom God evidently in this life means little or nothing. Now, if God means little or nothing to people in this life, how could heaven be a place where they would feel, let's say, happy, but even comfortable without the presence of God? So here in this vision of heaven, you see God is prominent in everything. Now, do any of you have any questions on anything in chapter 4 before we go on to chapter 5 here? Yes. Yeah, very likely. Three is the number of God in the Bible. Seven is the number of perfection. 10 is the number of completeness. You can make a study of symbolic numbers in the Bible, and this isn't imagination. There's surely something to this. And with a little more difficulty and hazard of colors and so on, too. But surely the number of God, the Trinity. When we come later to Chapter 13, here is the wild beast out of the sea, and his number is 666. And there's a great puzzle about what that means, and we'll have to look at the various possibilities of what that means. But maybe, just for a quickie preview, the most probable is that this is the number of man as contrasted with God that falls one short on every count. Instead of 777, which would be the triple perfection of God, is 666, the triple imperfection of man, is falling short on every count. Now, maybe that isn't the right meaning of it, but it's one that has been suggested. All right, any more questions on chapter 4?
Chapter
3/6. Well, according to this interpretation, it's the counterfeit of the Trinity. 3/7 would be the Trinity, see? Oh, sure. Still, there's no interpreting the book of Revelation without running a risk. And the alternatives are either leave it alone completely or run the risk. Now, I think we would hold that the value to be gotten from it outweighs the possibility of the risk. But when we get through, we ought to beware of the fellow who claims he knows it all. You know, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they can tell you exactly what every detail in this book means, and in Ezekiel and Daniel too. I would just as soon not know so much as to know so much that I couldn't be sure of. And obviously, when we get through, we'll have to say the greatest and wisest and saintliest of Christian scholars do not fully agree about all that's in this book, and it was given by God to bring a blessing to us, but also perhaps to challenge our effort. And surely it is possible to gain value from it without necessarily giving a final answer to every point. Now, anybody else got one? Yeah. Well, this is not exactly the same as it is in Ezekiel, and this appears other places in Scripture too. This has been explained, I think, various ways. One is to hold that the cherubim are not real living creatures at all, but that this is a purely symbolic or metaphorical construction here, standing for the whole creation. But Dr. Hendrickson, in his little book, says the cherubim cannot stand for the totality of the creation, because when John wants to speak of the whole creation, he does it in plain Greek or English, chapter 5, verse 13, every creature which is in heaven, and names it right out. So that's his opinion, of course. Did you have an explanation about that? Well, this has been worked out in great detail. Maybe this comes a little under the ban that Stu was mentioning of some risk of over-interpreting it. Now, that leads up to what I was going to say, that this is metaphor and pageantry through here, and not to be taken literally. It is put in here for dramatic effect. Not only this about the exact appearance of these living creatures, but much that comes after, what comes here in chapter 5. If you would try to take this literally as, let's say, a movie film or a series of candid shots with a camera would photograph it, you run into all sorts of problems and difficulties. And it is quite obvious that, you see, God is a spirit, the angels are spirits, the cherubim are spirits. They do not have a bodily form that can be measured or drawn in a picture or something like this. So they appeared in vision form to John to teach truth. But it is done in such a way that the glory of God, and the centrality of God, and in chapter 5, the redemptive work of Christ and his glory and kingship that followed that are brought into high relief by the description. And this is what we should notice in it. And it is pageantry, it is symbolism, it is idle for us to inquire literally, just as I believe last Sabbath we looked at the question of the 24 elders and which of the sons or grandsons of Jacob do these include, and does it include Paul or Matthias in place of Judas? And all of this is idle speculation. The purpose of this is to show the connection or the tie-in between the two dispensations of God's grace, the old and the new, that of Moses and that of Christ, or the Old Testament and the new. Now, this fourth chapter that we're leaving here should lead us, maybe taking it as a whole, to lift up our spiritual eyesight to God. We are so troubled in this world and so vexed with annoyances and sufferings and irritations and problems that we tend to become depressed. And the remedy for depression is not a tranquilizing pill. It may be a time in emergencies when these are legitimately used, but this is not the ordinary remedy for depression. The remedy for depression is to get your eyes fixed on a higher level, namely on God, who reigns in power and glory and supremacy, unchallenged and unchallengeable above all. So that the little things that bother us and get us down, the vexations of life and the disappointments and the unconscionable character of wicked people and so forth, will not bother us so much if we lift our eyesight and look towards the Lord in heaven. This is true. Now, as you look at the American people, how many do you see that have peace in their life and that have joy? And how many look like they were tense, anxious, insecure, and problem-ridden? That's the typical picture of our day. We have greater material prosperity than ever before, and less mental peace. We have tensions and anxieties and problems, and a Christian is not intended to live on that level. The Lord wants us to have peace and joy in our life, and you can't do it by looking on the ground right in front of your feet. Got to lift up your eyes to a higher level and realize that God is reigning and there's going to be a good outcome. It cannot be other than a good outcome, a supremely good outcome for everyone who is in Christ. And the wicked powers cannot really fight against God. This will give us new faith and patience and keep us from being too much disturbed by what is going on in the world. Now, this isn't only taught in Revelation, it's taught all through the Bible. Fret not thyself because of evildoers. Psalm 37. Neither be thou envious against them that work unrighteousness. Very good psalm. If you ever get to feeling low, you read Psalm 37, you get through reading that, read Psalm 27, and pray a little while. And I'll guarantee it'll work wonders for your mental attitude. Is that right, Dr. Wright? If anybody's tried it, no. Now then, we'll leave chapter 4 and say that this is intended to lead us, taking it as a whole, not just this or that detail, to think of God in His supreme glory in heaven. We've seen very different from poor John, a prisoner on the island of Patmos. Now, chapter 5, another vision here, or continuation. I saw in the right hand of him that sat on the throne a book, written within and on the back side, sealed with seven seals. Now, him that sat on the throne is God the Father, of course, here. And this book you should not think of as one of our books, but that you open up and it has pages with numbers. This would be a roll or a scroll, much larger than this probably, but sealed with seven seals down the edge here where it is closed. Now, many scrolls of this kind have been found in ancient times, and an ordinary one would have maybe just one seal. Maybe if it was something quite important, it would be three. But this one has seven seals. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, right down the edge there. This would indicate it is thoroughly sealed. Nobody is going to get to know what is in that book or have anything to do with it until somebody arrives that has the right and the power to break those seals open and see what's in the book. Seven seals. And besides this, it says written within and on the back side. Now this, I take it, the parchment is written full on both sides. So there is no space left. Everything is written full. What is this book? as you follow along here and see what happens with this book, you can see this book is the book of God's eternal plans and purposes for history, especially history as seen in the redemption of his people. But this involves the history of the world as a whole. This is Operation History, and it is sealed orders. Now, in wartime, sometimes a battleship will put out to sea with sealed orders. They don't want the enemy to get any information, you see, prematurely about where that ship's going. So they go out to sea 200 or 300 miles, and then at the appointed time, the captain will open the sealed orders and find out where the ship is supposed to go to, and before that, even the captain of the ship was not able to know. So this is even more secure than radio. Sealed orders. So this book is God's sealed orders for his plans for this world, if you will, his blueprint or his decree, and it is written full, so that it contains all that is relevant or that is involved here, written inside and outside, and then sealed with seven seals. So the question is now, who is able to open this book and read this? And notice how everything is set up here in a way to bring Jesus Christ into high relief, to bring out his power and his person very strongly against the entire scene. Even in the throne room of God in heaven, Jesus Christ gets the prominence here. A strong angel proclaims with a loud voice. There is a broadcast announcement over the angel's loudspeaker. Who is worthy to open the book and to loose the seals thereof? Now this again is put in surely for dramatic effect. Don't think for 1 minute that this angel didn't know who was going to open this book, or that he thought maybe there might be a volunteer from the 24 elders or something like that that would step forward and say, I'll try it, or anything of the kind. It's, the question is a rhetorical question asked here so that when the answer comes, it will emphasize more fully the qualification of Jesus Christ to do this. Who is worthy to open the book and to loose the seals thereof? Adequate for this. This means in person, in character, in power, in every way you look at it. Who is worthy? Worthy doesn't mean merely ethically worthy, that is, morally good enough, but who is qualified to do this? Who is there in the whole creation or the whole universe that can open the book of God's eternal plan? And this involves, as we will see, not only opening the book, but carrying it out. Now, as each of these seals is opened, there's a further vision. First seal is open, and John sees certain things. Second seal is open, and so on. This, however, if our understanding of the nature of these seven seals is correct, cannot be the contents of the book. You see, the contents couldn't be read until all seven seals were broken. Therefore, the contents of the book must come after the opening of the seventh seal. And what we have here at the opening of each of these is sort of another preface or preliminary vision that has some bearing on it. Now, no man in heaven or earth, neither under the earth, was able to open the book, neither to look thereon. This book is so exclusive and so holy that not only is there nobody qualified to open it, but there's nobody that is fit to look at it, or able to look at it, or let's say that ventures or that dares to look at it, neither to look thereon. Who but Jesus Christ can implement the eternal counsel of God in the created universe? No one. No man in heaven or earth or under the earth none of the 24 elders, none of the four living creatures, none of the great host of angels that are mentioned, no one. And John wept much, because no man was found able to open and read the book, neither to look thereon. Again, I take it this is put in for dramatic effect. You see, if it really turns out that nobody can open the book or look thereon, then this would be another way of saying God's eternal plan has flopped, it has failed, it cannot be carried into execution. There will be no redemption. There will be no God-given, let's say, favorable outcome of history. So John wept much. And then one of the elders, not this time one of the cherubim, but one of the elders, comes to him and says, "Don't weep. The Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed to open the book and to loose the seven seals thereof." Now, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, of course, is Jesus Christ. This is a reference to this in Genesis chapter 49, verses 9 and 10. This is where Jacob, shortly before his death, was pronouncing a blessing on his various sons, and some of them got a better blessing than others, but it speaks about Judah here. Genesis 49:9 and 10. "Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be." Certainly a prophecy of Christ, a messianic prophecy. Jesus Christ is of the tribe of Judah, one of Jacob's sons. And it speaks there of the scepter, the kingly authority, reigning as king. And this is the figure of Christ, the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Right afterwards it says the Root of David, who was also, you see, of the tribe of Judah. Christ is the son of David. He is the greater David. He is the fulfillment of the prophecies given to and through David as king. Now, the lion is spoken of in the book of Proverbs as the strongest among beasts who turneth not aside for any. We have lions in this country outside of circuses and zoos. We have lynxes and wildcats and mountain lions, but this speaks of a real lion. They had them in Bible times. Last record of a lion being killed in the Holy Land was 700 B.C., time of the Assyrian captivity. A lion, strongest among beasts, that turneth not aside for any. A powerful and dangerous animal. I read, while I was a speaker at the college, telling about a missionary on a jungle trail, and he, in Africa, I believe, he stopped and saw a lion up ahead. And there was no way to escape. He realized if he tried to run, the lion would take out after him, and if he stayed there, the lion would also be around to get him. So he knelt to say his final prayers. And when he opened his eyes, the lion was also kneeling with one paw over his eyes. And the lion said, "I don't know what you're doing, but I'm saying grace." Now, I don't know whether lions say grace before they eat missionaries, but the nearest thing we have to a lion in this country is the grizzly bear, a dangerous animal. One killed some people in Yellowstone Park just a year or two ago. A little book called None of These Diseases by a medical man named McMillan, and has a chapter in there on the high cost of getting even. And he narrates this interesting little item that in Yellowstone National Park, there is only one animal that dares to feed or drink alongside of a grizzly bear. And that animal is the skunk. the grizzly bear has learned by experience that you do not argue with a skunk, and if you do, there will be a consequence. So you could say the grizzly bear, like the lion, is powerful. It turns not aside for any. Skunk is the exception that proves the rule. And so when Christ is called a lion, this is a reference, and especially when he is called right after this, the root of David, a reference to his power as king, his kingly authority, the lion of the tribe of Judah. Now, C.S. Lewis, in his little children's story, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, has the lion for a figure of Christ. Lewis didn't invent that out of his head. He got it out of the Bible. For Christ is certainly described as a lion. It's a metaphor. It's not literal, of course, but it indicates his power, his unchallengeable strength, and his carrying through his purposes. Now, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has prevailed. This word in Greek is conquered. It indicates conquest of enemies and of difficulties. Not simply that he reached the rating to do this, but he has prevailed in a conflict, in a battle, to open the seal of the book, to loose the seven seals and open the book. Now, this is what one of the 24 elders tells John. Don't weep, because someone is known who can do this. The lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, is going to do it. And John turns to see what this is. And he turned and beheld, and lo, in the midst of the throne and of the four beasts and in the midst of the elders stood a lamb, as if it had been slain. He turns to see a lion, and he sees a lamb. And furthermore, nobody ever saw another lamb like this one. It has seven eyes and seven horns. Did you ever see a lamb with seven horns? Now, really, a lamb wouldn't even have one horn. A ram, a full-grown male sheep, would have two horns. Most breeds of sheep. But here's a lamb with seven horns and seven eyes. Again, this is pageantry. This is imagery put in for dramatic effect and surely not to be taken literally. A lamb as it had been slain. If you try to picture this, you can't do it with a drawing or a painting of it. How do you picture a lamb that has been slain and is still alive or is alive again? A reference, you see, to Christ, who is the one who was dead and is alive again. He was crucified, dead and buried. The third day he rose again from the dead, the Apostle Creed says. This is pictured in this way, and the imagery is contradictory. But it does this, regardless of logic, to teach truth here. A lamb as it had been slain. Now, when Jesus rose from the dead, not everybody recognized him immediately. He was evidently the same and yet different. The same body that was nailed to the cross and put in the tomb rose from the tomb and is that of Christ in heaven and forever, and yet glorified and changed to suit the status of eternity and transcendent glory. And yet we read about Jesus after his resurrection that the mark of the nails and of the soldier's spear were still there in his body. We recall Jesus appeared to his disciples and Thomas was absent, and later Thomas said he wouldn't believe unless he could put his finger in the print of the nails and thrust his hand into the hole in Jesus' side. And a week later, Jesus appeared again and said to Thomas, come hither, reach hither thy finger, and reach hither thy hand and thrust it into my side, and be not faithless but believing. And Thomas saw the evidence and was convinced and said, my Lord and my God. Now, therefore, even though you could say Jesus' body is transfigured into heavenly glory, it is identical, and the memorial of his sufferings and death on the cross remains forever. So what John sees here is a lamb as it had been slain. A lion, but a lamb as it had been slain. Seven head horns, the horn a symbol of power in the Bible. Over and over again, the horn is a symbol of power. You can trace it out by looking them up in a concordance. And the seven eyes would be a symbol of absolute knowledge. Seven, the perfect number. The eye, the symbol of knowing and seeing. So here is absolute knowledge and absolute power. And who is it? It is the one who was crucified, dead and buried, and the third day rose from the dead. Now, he came and took the book out of the right hand of him that sat upon the throne. Again, don't take it literally. How does a lamb pick up a book? There was a man boasted to a neighbor that he had his horse trained to walk down the lane to the RSC mailbox and get the morning newspaper in his teeth and bring it up the lane to the house. And wasn't this pretty good? And the neighbor said, yes, it's pretty good for a horse. But what would you think if somebody boasted about his 10-year-old son? That boy of mine is just only 10 years old. It's amazing what he can do. I've got him trained. He can pick up the newspaper and bring it back to the house. Expected of a boy, but not of a horse. Now, this doesn't mean that this lamb got the book in his teeth. And the lamb doesn't have any hands to pick up a book. Therefore, don't expect this imagery to be explainable in terms of a literal, point-by-point interpretation of it. The lamb took the book. Now, this implies more than merely looking at this. He is the one who is qualified and has won the victory and therefore has the right not only to know what's in this book, but to carry it out and make it a certainty in the real life. This that we have here is described elsewhere in the Bible as the enthronement of the mediator, Jesus Christ, as the King of Glory. Now, we'll stop there in just a minute, but I call your attention to verse 9 and 10. There's a textual problem about the Greek text in those two verses. They sung a new song. And who is this? The four living creatures and the 24 elders. And said, thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God and made us to our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. This describes humans who have been redeemed by the blood of Christ, but the four living creatures are angelic beings and have not been redeemed by the blood of Christ. Therefore, if it says thou hast redeemed us, this doesn't fit them. Now, the Revised Version and recent versions, based upon more accurate Greek text than the King James Version was, and it reads this way, thou hast was slain and hast redeemed men to God by thy blood, out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation, and hast made them unto our God kings and priests, and they shall reign upon the earth. It applies to humans who are redeemed and victorious, but not to the four living creatures. All right, we'll stop there for this time.